control, so we knew what was going as things were happening.
Right. How did this experience compare to others?
This is Rodney Greenblatt from Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Tune in WGXC's new Sunday morning schedule with the Reverend Kim Singletary, and There's a Bright Side Somewhere, every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. That's followed by the teens from Hudson talking about books they've read on Bound by Books. After the local news at 9 a.m. And at 10 a.m., there's more teens. The Catskill kids from Clubhouse Radio are on at 10 a.m. with lots of music and talk on your community radio station, WGXC.org, 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Elizabeth Powell Leather Items of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Race Talks, hosted by intercultural communicator and author Kimberly Y. Irwin, provides expertise on the topic of race and ethnicity. With the national conversation over racial inequity in the media, ignorance or indifference is not a comfortable retreat. Listeners may converse with the host, other expert guest educators, activists, organizers, and thoughtful community members as they disseminate their knowledge, i.e., varying terminologies, historical realities, and current opportunities for engagement for a better informed, appreciative, and active local citizenry.
Join Ms. Irwin and her scheduled guest talkers as they share their stories to make sure that the ignorance of race, the evil of racism, and ignoble inequality which have shaped them end and is not spread to another generation. Now,
welcome to Race Talks with Kimberly Y. Irwin. I'm your host, and I have three wonderful guests today. And we're going to pay homage to Martin Luther King Jr. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a person who we've all in America and around the world have decided to lift up to have us also join in understanding how we all can work together to end racism and cross the top of that mountain that he saw so many years ago. So I wanted to start off with a quote, but I will share with you my guest speakers today first to let you know how we're going to run the show today. So I'm going to give a quote that Martin Luther King Jr. had mentioned, and then we're going to have three guest speakers. These guests will share their stories, and we then will all have a chat together to discuss how others, maybe those in the listening area, can recognize how they too can overcome racism and share in the commitment of racial equality that Dr. Martin Luther King had. So here's his poem. Here's his quote. Power without love is reckless and abusive. And love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. And this was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Approximately 50 years ago. What a momentous occasion that it was when he made these words, made this statement. And I wanted to choose power without love, because when we talk about race and ethnicity, the one word that comes up above everything else is racism. And I wanted to start Race Talks to make sure we understand what racism is. So many people have a different definition. So I want to share what Race Talks uses as its definition. So first, the dictionary definition is prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed against a person or people on the basis of their membership in a particular racial or ethnic group, typically one that is a minority or marginalized. And most people around the activism of racism to end it would say that there's one thing missing, and that is power. And power breeds control. So when we listen to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s statement, power without love is reckless and abusive, that's what we're looking at when we see, when we hear racism. It's definitely prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism, but it's because of the power dynamic. And that's what we are looking at when we talk about racism. So my first, well, let me just mention the guests today are Carlson Tillman, and we also have, who is in law enforcement, and we also have a wonderful activist against, or I should say, for undoing racism, and that's Peter Heyman. He'll be our last talker, and our first one is our very own Hudson-born and bred minister, or I should say pastor, Ernest Collins. So Pastor Collins, welcome. And can we ask you to share, can I ask you to share a little bit about who you are and share why you would like to share your story about overcoming certain dynamics and racism and how you can connect your story to Martin Luther King's dream?
Well, thank you, Kim. My name is Ernest Collins. Now I'm 42 years old, and I lived in Hudson for all of my life, but moved to Binghamton 12 years ago to pastor a church. I grew up in a church, was a youth pastor for many years, for 10 years, and now I'm the senior pastor, but I have 7 children, and that's a big part of my motivation. I have 7 children that are growing up and going to be observing, living, and learning in this world. And I wanted them to have a good foundation of how this world works, or my experience of how it works.
Well, with 7 children, you definitely can give a lot of interesting topics and terminologies with them growing up. Tell me about one of the stories that you shared initially about working and how you can have people come to your side just by being proactive and positive.
Well, I worked in a company, a masonry company, where, you know, there was probably about 60 employees in the field, and I was the only Black guy there. At the time, I was just 20 years old, and a lot of older white men, and some young guys as well. And it was difficult. It was difficult. Not everybody treated me poorly. Most people, they didn't. But there was quite a few that did, because, like I said, basically they were prejudiced, and that was the way it was. And like I said, I began to grow and develop in the company. Was there? I used to drive the boss to work, and they used to say I was driving Miss Daisy.
So what was that movie, Driving Miss Daisy? That was back in what, 15 years ago? It seems like it was just yesterday, but it was a while.
Yeah. Right. All right. So I was driving Miss Daisy.
How old were you around that time?
So I think the movie was longer than 15 years ago, because I think it was more like 20 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I was just...
Well, I don't want to show my age.
Yeah, I was actually an apprentice. I had just started, and the boss actually would pick me up and drive me to work. He was like a second dad to me. But he would pick me up, and all the guys would come in, and they would say that I was driving Miss Daisy. Throughout the course of day, every day, I will hear racial terms and different things that were demeaning. But nobody ever was violent, but more just verbal, very verbal. And
okay, let me ask you, when you said very verbal, are they screaming these epithets at you, or is it under their breath? Just
no,
and not your boss know? How is it coming across?
Well, not so much screaming, but consistent. Consistent, you know what I'm saying? I had a very strong understanding of how people felt. It wasn't no, like, you know, one good thing was it wasn't a mystery.
Well, yeah, they do say that if it's under the table, it's harder to deal with, but you knew what it was, so you knew how to combat it.
Right, I knew what it was, but I had a foundation in Christ at the time, and I didn't grow up racist. I didn't grow up racist. My mom didn't, and my dad didn't raise me that way. Actually, at the time, my pastor was actually white. My pastor, my mentor, my other father figure. So I didn't embrace racism. So I stayed the course and just, you know, not acknowledging them. But many times I wanted to quit, but for some reason, the Lord really never let me quit. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel the liberty to be able to quit.
Let me ask you, you know, we talk about safe spaces now in the 21st century. Did you find that you had a safe space somewhere in that in that job? A person you can go to and speak to?
Not necessarily, but what my boss would do, the one, Miss Daisy, the one that actually would drive to work.
Mr. Daisy.
Mr. Daisy. They always said Miss Daisy. I always wondered, like, why they never said Mr. Daisy? But what he would do occasionally, he would actually quite frequently, he would send me off on a job of my own. And actually, I would run that project and begin to learn. And he did that, you know, he did that several times a year, where I would go away for about 3 weeks and I'll have a project that I was actually running. And I actually, you know, like I said, I would do that. So that was like encouragement to me. But you know, so the more about the story was, I worked with these men for 10 years, and I just felt like if they got the chance to know me, that they would like me. Because a lot of them, they, you know, like I said, I came in, I was, you know, driving Mr. Daisy. I was called the golden boy because, you know what I'm saying? Like I said, so there was a lot of things, but I felt like if they got the chance to know me, they would actually like me.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that they might have had an opportunity to see other Black people at other times, or were you like one of the first people of color with darker skin that they had to address in some way?
But maybe on that particular job, I think I was the only one there at that job. You know what I'm saying? So I kind of like entered into that arena, and it was like, you know, if there was a way of the way they did things, and I kind of like entered in, and it was, you know, so everybody was basically themselves.
So your presence was uncomfortable for them.
Yes, absolutely.
You try to keep your head down to make them feel a little bit more or less, more comfortable or less threatened to somebody.
I kept my head down. As a matter of fact, a lot of guys were older. I had to go to transition because we did not grow up calling older people by their first name. So it's like it was a lot. I didn't know what to do because I'm thinking, you know, a lot of guys were older and like, you know, I can't just call a guy, but you know, I just didn't grow up. So there was a lot of maturing that actually took place in me while working there. But yeah, it did. It made them feel uncomfortable because it's like I was there, but I was no threat. I was never a threat. Not at the beginning, and I'll tell you why. It was not at the beginning. I felt like if I can build a relationship with somebody with the guys that you know, we wouldn't have a problem.
And we only have like a couple of minutes left. So when did you become a threat?
Okay. So what happened was just that very thing happened. Consistency. I continued to demonstrate that I had values, that I had purpose, that I had an attitude that I wanted to do a good job. And they begin to learn my character a little bit more. And they begin to learn my character a little bit more. And they, like I said, actually begin to trust me more. And as a matter of fact, one particular instance, and I know I got much time, I was told, and like I said, I was told there was a young guy that was dragged by a truck in Mississippi. I was told by one of the guys, and he said it laughing and joking. He said, "Ernest, I wish that was you."
Oh, no.
Yep. So that's bad, right?
Right.
Now, I you know what I said to him at the time? I said, "You're very stupid." So I that's what I said. I said, you're very stupid. But, okay, so now I'm going to start talking about how we kind of overcame. Well, that same guy, just to give a testimony of character, that same guy, when it came, I was a youth pastor, that same guy came to me and asked me if I would help communicate to his daughter that was kind of going astray. So basically what happened was over a period of 10 years, we kind of won the favor of all these people.
Okay. So by you being positive, doing what you need to do in work and having the right ethic and the mindset and not really going low, like what Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high. So you were going, you kept on the righteous path.
I kept on the righteous path with the foundation of Christ, loving people. And I think it demonstrated that people are, you can't judge a person by their skin color. You have to judge them by who they are. And I've seen that reality where.
So he came out and asked you for your help with his daughter. And did you give it?
I absolutely did. As a matter of fact, before I left that company, moved here to the pastor, I was helping most of the guys because I was a pastor. And because, like I said, a lot of times the men don't express their needs, but because I worked in such close proximity with all of them, a lot of time that's what I was doing. I was actually ministering to the guys and helping encourage and build them up. And I told them, so this is one thing when I was younger, when I first started, I was being treated. I said, "Guys, here's what's going to happen." I said, "One of these days, you guys are going to call me FBF. And they said, "What is that?" I said, "First Black Foreman." Well, just to make a long story short, before I left, indeed, I actually became the first Black foreman of that company, and actually,
yeah, I mean, bravo! And did they celebrate with you? Because I think that's what I'd like to have come from this conversation, that we don't just tolerate people. We're not looking for tolerance. We're looking or acceptance even, but real celebration of each other's humanity. So were they able to celebrate that with you?
No, they didn't celebrate because they were men and they were jealous. But what happened was all these guys became my friends. All became my friends. And my first project was that Walmart, Super Walmart in Hudson, in Greenport. That Super Walmart in Hudson?
Yes.
That was my first project where I had a crew of six guys with me, and we actually did all the caulking on that project.
Wait, you went from driving Mr. Daisy and thinking, "I'm going to quit because of these racial epithets. People just don't really feel me here. I'm not feeling comfortable," to going about ministering to a person in need, though they've treated you badly over the years. You went and helped his daughter, and then you climbed the ladder of success, and then you brought along those others with you. Well, after, let me ask you, because that's another question for the future, but one of the things that Martin Luther King Jr. wanted was equity. So was there any other African-American males or people from other cultures, ethnicities, that were able to join your company after you were the first one?
I might have been the first and only one with that company. I actually became part of the, I might have became part of the family. Like I said, it was a family, and as well, it was a different ethnicity. So it was kind of a close knit situation, but through consistency and like I said, I believe through the love of Christ, we were able to break down some of the barriers. And those, you know, ultimately, like I said, the guys, they, you know, you use the word, did they celebrate with me? Did they appreciate me and what I did and what I became? Absolutely.
That's another word with celebrate, appreciate. So thank you for sharing that. Thank you so much, Minister Collins.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Please stay where you are, because we have two more guests, and I know they'd probably like to converse a little bit more with you at the end. So thank you again. So I'm going to ask for a moment to just look at Martin Luther King's, one of his last books that actually I don't think it was printed at the time, was Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? And I think that's where we are today, looking at chaos for sure with what's happening in our, well, you know, every state. It seems like we're looking at chaos because of our who we decided we want to elect as our president. But also, do we go to chaos or do we go to community? Now, it's really interesting because some of the Republicans and Democrats now are actually coming together in some way to, maybe not a large way, but in some way to build a bigger bridge so we can fight the chaos over who was elected. And I think it's a really great book that analyzes America's race relations. And, you know, people like to say, especially in other countries, because I lived in other countries and I have friends around the world, that race relations are really bad in the United States. But I think race relations are bad anywhere where we think that there is more than one race. You know, if you think there's more than the human race, then you may have a problem with other people. So I'd like to make sure that we recognize that all ethnicity groups are important and valued. And I think my next guest, Carlson Tillman, will share a little of that story, of his story with us, that will share with us also how, you know, his triumphant over racism came, you know, like yours did. It started while he was young, and then he had to work very hard to overcome. And this is an area, not in ministry, but in law enforcement. So Carlson, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you?
Share a little bit about yourself and let us know your story.
Yes, my name is Carlson Tillman, 56 years old, proud USMC veteran, just recently retired from New York State, 31 years on the job.
Wow. Okay. So you said USMC?
United States Marine Corps.
There you go. Spell it out to us. Okay. Wonderful. Well, like everyone says, thank you for serving our country. But I have to say, I know this is an aside, but would you recommend that young people enter the armed forces? I was thinking always against it. You know, Martin Luther King did not like, obviously, violence. He was about nonviolent. And he, although we celebrate him today and we have a holiday and a memorial at our state's capital, at our country's capital, there was a lot of people that were against him because of the Vietnam War. He came out against that. So as a person, as a veteran of a institution that, you know, is supposed to be for peace, but is also for war, what would you say to our youth today about the value of representing our country in that way?
Well, I would say it's about your options that you have. Personally, I would say, yeah, but I do understand, you know, some people want to go to college, which I totally for, but you know, sometimes everybody doesn't have that option. And in the military, I say is a good choice. I think people think when you're in the military, it's fight, fight, fight. Not necessarily. You study for that ASVAB, you score high enough, you pretty much do everything in the military that you do in the civilian world. So I think that's a notion that some people be afraid, oh, if I join, I'm be fighting, blah, 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 blah. Not the case at all. Study for that ASVAB, score high, you could do great things.
And your choice of going into the military, did that come out of wanting to be successful in a way in which you didn't see growing up?
Well, you know, I'm a graduate of 1983. So at the time when I completed high school.
Is that Hudson High School, Carlson?
Hudson High School, Blue Hawks.
Okay, Blue Hawks.
Yes, ma'am. But for me, I wasn't really ready to go to college, but I knew I wanted to do something. Wanted to get out of Hudson, you know, small population, probably had to be under 5,000 at that time. Well, maybe a little more, but it was like, you know, just wanted to get away and do something, see the world and all that good stuff.
What was your experience in Hudson?
Oh, well.
Small town Hudson.
Well, you know, the school system was challenging from elementary school. I think didn't really have a lot of role models. You didn't see a lot of people of color teaching. So I think, and I don't know if they had ethnicity training or not, but at times it didn't feel like it. There was always a lack of understanding. Now you're talking about early 70s, 71, 72. So wasn't very many role models. So I don't think, you know, young Black kids got that understanding.
That now you need role models like in institutions like schools and teachers. A doctor or something like that.
All of that, okay. All of that in Hudson. So yeah, you felt kind of like you didn't get that understanding that you may have needed or wanted.
Now, so, let's talk about you, because did you feel that you lack that? You know, because I know you're saying you, so I'm just trying to bring it back to you and your story. So you felt that it was lacking for you. Did you have no teachers of color or anyone that you can go to and like have a safe space? Did you need a safe space? Did you feel like there was, you know, something called racism out there, even though?
Well, certainly back then, didn't know it to be that. But looking back now, felt like it. Now, I'm just give you a little example. Going through the lunch line back then, you had free lunch or you paid for your own lunch.
I had free lunch.
But it was just like, you know, at the time, you know, I could afford. My mom's always gave us money to pay for our lunch. But the aide used to have a sheet that, you know, she would go to for people on free lunch and check your name off. I used to get a little annoyed that as soon as I get to the end of the line, she would pick up her paper and just expect me to give her my name. And so that used to frustrate me all the time.
Let me make sure I understand that. So because you were African-American, she thought that you couldn't afford your lunch.
Well, they automatically pick up that sheet of paper and expect you to tell them your name so they can check you off. They used to, back then, used to get paddles. And it was like a, almost felt like a spectacle. Because I ain't never see too many, you know, white kids get that paddle, but it always felt like when a Black kid would get the paddle, it was like a shelter. Stand up, put your hands on the desk. And the teacher would either take one or two. Thought that was crazy. Never seen anything like that.
Well, I do remember, because I, you know, I grew up in the same school district as you, and I do, and I'm a little bit younger, but I do remember them stopping paddling in about, I think I was in second grade. So I don't know where that came from, the stopping of the paddling, but yeah, I think it's certainly something that was, had happened. And you felt that it was, again, where since young Black kids didn't have an advocate, and you know, another teacher or someone in the system that could recognize that this student isn't behaving any more any badly than another student in any way, but they just didn't feel comfortable with your behavior because of the color of your skin. That's what you felt.
That's exactly how I felt. Now, we did have an assistant principal that was Black, Mr. John Fowler, and it seemed like we all gravitated towards him. Whenever we had a problem, we didn't want to talk to nobody but Mr. Fowler.
And so, how wonderful.
So you've seen that in elementary school. Now, middle school, we had a couple. We had a music teacher by the name of Miss Underdew, and we had a reading teacher by the name of Miss Winston. And of course, back then, you know, as far as music classes, we all wanted to go to Miss Underdew. You know, we didn't want to listen to Glen Campbell, Rhinestone Cowboy. We wanted to listen to Earth, Wind & Fire. So, you know, and it was crazy because we all would want, you know, requests to go to Miss Underdew. The first few got in, but I must have been too late because I had to stick with Miss Hanson. So I was singing Rhinestone Cowboy, Benny and the Jets. So that's how that was.
So there was a segregation of even music at the time.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Miss Underdew class used to be, I mean, we would stop and just hang out outside her door because everybody's singing. Everybody, class participation was at its highest. Everybody wanted to sing those songs. So
what I'm understanding is for you, it wasn't like this for me, but for you, you did have some role models that were people, teachers of color or the assistant principal. And so, but because there was like one, you recognized that there was a lack of it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And like I say, sometimes you just felt like the teachers weren't sensitive enough to how we learn. You know, you couldn't, they thought everybody learned the same, and I thought which was wrong. So that's when you start thinking about, you know, ethnicity training. Did they have it?
Actually, and you're right. There was a study done, I think it was in the, I don't want to get the date wrong, but someone can look up 60s or 70s, late 60s or 70s, where they, you know, the whole study around Ebonics was done, and they showed that young children that were African American, they learned more by orally, by listening, as opposed to visually. You know, we like to hear stories being told to us, so that, you know, if we could hear a lot of the things that are happening. I know that that's probably one of the reasons why I learned my ABC so fast, because it was a song. I could sing ABC. I mean, I learned that in 5 seconds flat, but you know, obviously anything later that had anything with a musical tone or something, I was able to learn it quicker than just, you know, reading it in a book. And I was an avid reader. So I don't know, it made sense to me, definitely, that we learn differently. So let me ask you, because when we talk to, well, first, so, as a young African male growing up and not having a lot of role models, do you feel you went into the service to have more of that camaraderie, or how did it affect your life going forward in a way? So how did you, like in a sense, how did you overcome that, those feelings of being seen differently or having discriminatory behaviors from even just a person so benign as the lunch lady?
Well, let me say that I was blessed. I grew up around a lot of strong Black women. My aunts older cousins, so that, you know, it made you curious. It made you, you know, think why, or else that lunch line thing could have happened. I wouldn't have thought nothing about it. But because the strong women in my life, you know, that's not fair. People just can't treat you anyway. People shouldn't assume things like that. So
that was as a young Black boy, did you feel fear being around other people who were not Black? For example, you know, as a young Black, being young and Black, people say, you know, white people have a fear of the young Black male. Is there any fear coming from the young Black male towards white people?
Well, see, now that's the funny thing. Growing up back then, Hudson was very unique because pretty much all Black folks lived below 4th Street. You know, most, the majority of us. And so.
Yep, I did. I lived.
So yeah. It was like back in the early 70s, Black kids played with Black kids, white kids played with white kids. And it was a time I was playing Little League on the Antlers. And I remember walking up past 4th Street, had to go to the Little League field. And, you know, you just got, at the time, very uncomfortable feeling. Like, people looking at me, white folks looking at me like, why are you up here?
Mm.
Strange. It just felt wrong. Again, this is my experience. And I'm pretty sure some other folks out there remember that feeling. You know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it's cool. You up there spending money. Early in the week, you just always had a sense that they looking at you like, why are you up here? As far as
the racism. When you say they, you mean white people, white males, just in.
Males, white males. Mm-hmm. And then as far as racism, it wasn't that in your face racism, caveman type racism. It was that subtle racism. You would hear things like, he's okay. He's not like the rest of them.
Mm.
You would hear things like that. A friend of mine was just telling me the other day, her experience. White woman walked up to her and said, you got nice hair for a Black girl.
Whoa.
Who says that?
Yeah.
Who says things like that? You know?
Well, so, that sounds like a term we would consider white privilege, where it would be nothing. So a person doesn't have to think about what they're saying because they feel what they're saying is normal.
Yes. They would say these things right in front of you, had no problem, without hesitation. Like I said, it wasn't that profanity and all that. They would just say it, like you said, as if I can say it.
Now, we're coming up to a few last minutes with your story. Can you share some ways in which you've handled that successfully? You shared that you had strong Black women in your life. That was helpful. Your parent, and you are actually a parent of another person. I mean, it might be understood that because you're Black, that your children, your offspring would be other people of color, but that's not always the case. But in your case, it is. Although it's not technically Black, it's Latino, right?
Yes, Puerto Rican, yes.
Now, if I can ask you, what have you learned, if I'm sure you've learned something. So what have you learned that you may have passed on and became an advocate for your own children?
Well, like I said, since my own experiences, elementary school, middle school, and high school, we didn't get a chance to get to that. When I was blessed with children, it was no way I was going to let my children be in Hudson City School District and I don't be a part of that somehow, some way. So I would volunteer. I ran a program in Greenport called Special Friends, where it started off where kids that did well, excelled in class, I would come by, give them a break, take them outside, you know, let them play for a few minutes, you know, talk to them, ask them how their day going. That's how it started. As it went along, then it was that ugly little word called being disruptive in class. And that could be anything from if a child just sat there not saying a word, he would get a referral. And I'll ask, well, why is he here or she here? Well, they was disrupting the class, but what did they do? They wasn't doing anything. They wasn't talking. The other kids was too busy concentrating on them. And I used to think that was sad. Mm-hmm. I used to think that was very sad. So I stuck with it, stayed with it until the program, you know, the budget ran out and they couldn't afford to, for me to do that. Did the lunch aid thing for years.
You did the lunch aid thing?
Yes, I did. Funny, right? Funny, right? Cool. I came back around, so yeah.
I know, that's like full circle. Isn't life is so strange that way? It gives us an opportunity to right wrong, I think.
Yes, it is. But then I hooked up with the after-school program as my kids got older. Great program, enjoyed it. Got to meet a lot of different kids. And for some reason, you know, they took a liking to me. I don't know why. Personality, I don't know. My friends.
Your personality, Carlson.
So, you know, but that was a great time. Enjoyed that. So then involved in the school, teachers knew who I was. They obviously knew who my kids were. So I always felt like they got an understanding. So, you know, without sending them to, you know, referrals and in-school suspensions, and if my kids had a problem, they would come to me. So that was cool. I liked that. Then I got the chance to serve on a few committees. So it was good. It was good. Glad I did it. Gave other little kids of color a chance to see somebody else of color in the building. And yeah,
very proud of that. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I love that kind of advocacy. And I mean, my mother was definitely an advocate for me when I wanted something that was so absolutely a no-no, like going to Columbia Green Community College in your senior year of high school. No, absolutely not. My mother ran up to the school when she heard that I was going to quit school because I couldn't I couldn't go to college early. And she made it happen. Of course, without that kind of advocacy, we can feel lost. So I mean, I appreciate that you shared that story, because it shows that parents, you have to run towards the problem, not run away from it.
Absolutely. And
right? Because you have to like engage in something. So I want to introduce this next guest by reading something from Martin Luther King Jr., but I don't want to take that much time. All I'll say about this is he mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. mentioned Black Power as a movement. And he was understanding that he understood that the Black Power movement could have been seen as both positive and negative. Positive as a slogan to call Black people to arms for political and economic gains and to strengthen their beliefs and to achieve their goals, but also as like to reject their white counterparts and to then want to end interracial coalitions and future ideas of going forward together. So that dichotomy is at play often in everything we do. I know when sometimes I say something to somebody and they want to call me being a racist. And how am I a racist? I'm just talking about, just by talking about issues don't make you a racist. Again, racism is where you are negatively displaying power over someone else of a different culture because you have the means. And so I'm not even going to explain anymore. I'm just going to say hello to my next guest. And most favored in the last couple meetings that we've had, because we've spoken like over 2 hours. So I'm basically going to let you say whatever you'd like to say as an undoing racism activist and trainer. Peter Heyman, share a little bit about who you are with our audience and how Martin Luther King Jr. is can be a focal point in what we do going forward in ending racism.
Well, thank you so much, Kimberly, and Pastor Ernest and Carlson. I'm really honored to be on the same show. I'm kind of wise to you. I see what you're doing here. Maybe, I don't know if it was by choice or whatever. We've got several generations here. I'm the older generation. My older son, Pastor Ernest, is your age. So I kind of relate to that. So I was very much alive when Martin Luther King was around and speaking. And you know, that's how old I am. Okay.
I'm sorry. I said, wow, loud.
And so I remember him, but so I'm a white man, grew up in suburban USA in northern New Jersey, Whitelandia, it was an all white community. It bordered on a small city called Paterson. You probably have heard of Paterson, New Jersey. And in the 60s, that Paterson was one of those little cities that went on fire with the civil rights protests and reaction to the protest. And it was literally, we were divided by a river. That could have been a 30-foot wall. It was so separate. Black people, other groups of color were not allowed to move into my town of Fairlawn. So I grew up in Lily White Landia. My parents were quote unquote liberal. We would call them progressive today. Yet, was it without racism? No. I look back and I hear, you know, my wonderful mother, who was very liberal, but she had deep-seated racism in her. She would comment on the black entertainers who were on TV at the time, like Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald. Remember, I said I'm old. And she would comment about them.
All know them. Those, you know, they live forever.
They live forever. And they are among the greatest performers ever, right? Ever. And she would like comment about their looks. It was terrible. So, you know, was I raised without racism? No. You can't be white in America and not have been exposed to racism, whether it's in the family or in the community. Now, I can't go into my life because it's too long, but I've been in sales, marketing, and advertising. And then I made a transition into social justice work. I had the great opportunity to work for a social justice agency in Nyack, New York. And wow, did that open up my eyes. Now, I've always been interested in civil rights. When I was in college in the late 60s, there was a huge civil rights movement. It was anti-war movement. Carlson mentioned that about, or I guess, Kimberly, you mentioned about the Vietnam War. That brought, you know, white and black students together. It was amazing. The Black Panther Party was being formed. Mm-hmm. I went through a stage of wanting to be black, which a lot of white kids wanted to be. It was cooler to be.
Well, I didn't know that happened before rap music.
So yeah, no.
Every generation has their moment.
Oh, no, it was definitely true. It was definitely true. Maybe I was the only one. I don't know. No, it's not true. Those were the times that I grew up in. And later on, when I worked for the social service agency, I got trained in undoing racism, undoing sexism. I worked for a program called the Domestic Violence Program for Men. And we were trained to work against all oppression. And that is now my mission, my purpose in life. Because I happen to believe that, you know, racism, it's not a black problem, it's a white problem.
Yes.
We created it, we meaning white folks. And the other thing I just wanted to point out, you know, I'm bouncing around, I'm sorry, but
around.
With the craziness of today, of what's going on today, last week, what happened in Washington, the attack on the Capitol, and you hear the phrase, you've heard it from politicians, from other people, that's not America, that's not us. Yeah. Well, I'm here to tell you, people on the phone, on the call, I mean.
The radio.
The radio. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, except I just want to emphasize it. That is America. Yeah. We have been steeped in racism, hatred, violence, oppression since the founding of our nation. And every generation sees this kind of activity. You could trace it back. There's a great book now called Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. Fantastic book, which chronicles this kind of history of the right-wing movements and the white supremacist movements. It's nothing new. And we will never get rid of it until we dig in and face it. And I've been fortunate to be trained in what's called the Undoing Racism Workshops, which is that deep, long conversation about race that everybody says we need. It's a 2.5-day really deep dive into racism. The trainers are always multiracial. So when I went through the training and then they needed a white guy to round out the team, they'd call me, send me to Houston or send me to Washington. The greatest experience of my life. I learned so much about myself, about my own racism. I also want to underscore, Kimberly, something you said at the very beginning when you added power to the definition.
Yeah.
That's what the Undoing Racism Workshop goes through. It redefines racism. And racism is what we call it, racial prejudice plus power mm-hmm. equals racism. And so I don't know if my fellow participants here are going to agree with this, but if you subscribe to that definition, the conclusion is only white people, in America I'm talking about, only white people can be racist because of that power. It's not to say that Black people, people of color, BIPOC people can't be mean, nasty, hurtful, harmful, prejudiced,
biased,
prejudiced, bigoted, all
we're human. Things.
But if you define racism as mm-hmm. having the power over, that's the distinction. And yeah. I happen to subscribe to that. I think that's really true. So my work is mostly with white people. That's what my work is. I have to communicate with white people. I have to help them stop and look. And you talk about privilege. Listening to Pastor Ernest and Carlson's stories, you know, they had a story of overcoming this racism. I picture them as, you know, six-year-old boys in school. You had a lot to overcome. I didn't have to overcome anything. I never walked into a room that I wasn't assumed to be my room, that I wouldn't be listened to, that I wouldn't be, you know, expected to perform well. You know, there was nobody pushing me down. So, you know, I really feel for your stories, and you know, I really appreciate your openness about it. And my story is to, oh, I wanted to give you another Martin Luther King quote, one of my favorite ones. Could I do that, Kimberly?
Oh, yes.
It's not that long. He said, "In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." Mm-hmm. That's what's really key. So my role is with white people, particularly white liberals, and say it's not enough to just say you're this or that. We need action. We need to stand for things. We need to stand for equality and justice for all.
And Peter, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's, of course, why I wanted to do Race Talks, was so that, well, as I was writing my book, one of the many I had started and kind of put to the side, but this one is really important because it's really about overcoming racism. I would go to these coffee shops and people would, you know, sit down and talk, sit next to me and ask me what I've been, you know, what am I writing? And then I would tell them it's about overcoming racism. And the majority of these people, if not every single one of them, were white people. And they would just then want to talk to me and share stories with me about their experience. Some of what you've said. And it's, you know, people have taken it out of the context when we talk about white privilege, making it seem like it's a, you know, something to hide behind and get angry about. What is. I mean, it's no sense of hiding and getting angry. It's what do you do with it to, you know, like you said, what action do you take so that you can change the scenario and end this generational scourge on our land, on our people, on our humanity. And so obviously everyone can't be Peter Heyman, unfortunately, and join in an activity or in a workshop. What do you say in these workshops for people to do? What one thing can they do? Can you share with people who have white privilege but don't want to own up to it because it's too painful, maybe to so they rather say it doesn't exist, but we all obviously know it does exist.
Well, you know, language is really important, and privilege really sets white people off. I've had conversations with people who just get so angry. White people, what do you mean privilege? My father had to work 3 jobs. You know, I have to work 2 jobs. You know, the economy's not doing so well. So maybe we need to find another word. Maybe it's benefits, white benefits that are white privilege. I heard that used recently because it's kind of loaded. I mean, but it's true. I was raised with privilege, unearned, unasked for, born to privilege just by being white in America. I again, you know, I can go into any room and feel I can talk and I will be listened to. I can travel. I can move. I can go to a store and I don't have to worry about being followed. You know, all those things, you know? So your question about what can white people do or should do? First, we have to open up ourselves to just take a look, really take a look. And the other thing about, I just want to point out about the workshops that I'm involved in, and there are other fine workshops and seminars also. Dive into them. If you're a white person, dive into it. Buy books. That book I mentioned, Cast. There's so many great books. There's a great book called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by a professor. Are you familiar with that? I see you shake your head. Anyhow, it's an amazing title, isn't it? And a professor out in Oregon, Dr. Joy DeGruy, this is her life's work, Black woman. And it takes you through, again, the history of America. We have to look at our history instead of denying it. We have this thing we call, you know, you've heard the phrase American exceptionalism.
Yes.
People like to use that. There's nothing exceptional about Americans, except we like to talk about it as if we're exceptional. If you know, 300 plus years of racism and oppression and sexism and patriarchy is exceptional, I don't think so.
Well, I think, Peter, you're getting along the, you're using terms that might make you be considered not an American patriot.
Great point. Great.
But we know that if you stand up and use your voice, what then you are a patriot. And that is exactly what our veterans like Carlson are fighting for us to have the ability to be vocal about making a change that's better for all of humanity. I am the host, but I don't want to be the only one asking questions. So this is the time when anybody, any guest can ask another guest a question or to share in, their thoughts about what another guest has said. Are there any takers?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask a question of either of you or both of you, I mean, Carlson and Pastor Ernest, if any of your experiences, how they led to any organizing work around undoing racism or solving some of these issues? Have you gotten involved with that on a local level?
Well, this is Carlson speaking now. I feel today is the first day being on this program.
Yeah.
Being able to share, each one teach one.
Thank you.
That's how I feel about it, so.
Great point, great point.
And thank you, Carl. And I'm vocal. Even today in the car, I corrected a statement that was made that, you know, I see beauty in all of God's creation. Everybody's beautiful. I'm talking about just, you know, they're all created by God. They're all created with purpose. And I was in a car today with several other guys and I was just, you know, someone had made a statement that was, you know, maybe stating that one race was superior than the other. And I'm thinking everybody is so important, you know what I'm saying? So I haven't in any other way other than just through, you know, my beliefs of, you know, my belief system, but very vocal. And so that's more of my activity, but I don't know if I really had an opportunity or thought to do anything beyond that. So.
You probably do it in your work, in your not only preaching, but working with families, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I have to say we've had a great conversation. I want to recognize again that this is paying homage to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And of course, that's one reason why I had on male guests. So I know there are people listening who are like, where are the women? And believe me, they're coming because in March is Women's Day and you won't see not one guy on this program. So that's why I wanted to host this show with males. So if anyone's out there want to give me problems, there it is. I want to end this with Love Is My Religion Isn't that a good one to pick? It's on the album Playing for Change, which is a featured Ziggy Marley. I want to thank my guest talkers, Pastor Ernest Collins, Peter Heyman, and Carlson Tilson. Thank you, guys.